Hi, I'm Connie Loizis.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Happy Friday! It's June 26th, and in this week's edition, we are going to zip through a handful of stories, starting with the abrupt departure of Alexis Ohanian from the venture firm that he co-founded in 2012, Initialized Capital. Alexis has run the firm with his fellow former founder, Gary Tan, both of whom had joined Y Combinator as partners after starting their companies. In Alexis's case, this was Reddit. In Gary's case, this was the blogging platform called Posterous. They struck out on their own and they have raised four funds. But according to an Axios report, Ohanian now wants to start backing companies that are too nascent, even for Initialized. So Gary is going to continue on with Initialized, and Alexis is going to be doing his own thing. It's interesting to me and surprising, honestly, given that I talked with both of them a few months ago at a Strictly VC event where they seemed not only very supportive of one another, but where we discussed specifically how early is too early for Initialized to get involved with a company. And Gary himself told me, quote, no traction is fine. In any case, I don't know if there's more to this story. I don't imagine that raising money will be a big issue for either, but it'll be interesting to see where this story heads.
The advertising policies of Google and Facebook were also in the news this week. Facebook is trying to stanch a river of bad press caused by the defection of advertisers not happy with Facebook's stance towards hate speech and misinformation. A group of progressive brands, Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, North Face, Eddie Bauer, and REI, are halting all advertising on the platform. And this week, Verizon, a huge advertiser, hit the pause button, and Unilever is also quitting the service. Even worse, advertising behemoth Procter & Gamble is reportedly re-examining its advertising on different platforms, including Facebook. These brands made their decisions to pull back from Facebook after the Anti-Defamation League and NAACP called on advertisers to pull ad spending from Facebook for the month of July. Facebook says it's trying its best. It claims that 89% of the hate speech it removed from October to March was detected by its systems before anyone reported it to the company, versus just 23% 3 years ago. But Zuckerberg continues to maintain that Facebook is neutral. On Tuesday, he told a meeting of advertisers that political content can be seen as egregious by one side and not by the other. Today, he said that Facebook would label posts by Trump and others that violate its speech policies as, quote, newsworthy in an effort to allay advertiser fears. Right. Google is also trying to play it cute. On Wednesday, it announced that it will set the location and search history of new users to auto-delete after 18 months. Google's auto-delete feature applies to search history, location history, and voice commands. The new defaults will only apply to new users, and existing Google accounts won't see any change. However, Google says it will also be promoting the option for existing users to revise their auto-delete settings on the search page and on YouTube. Does any of this make a difference? No. In reality, location and search history rapidly lose their value over time. What matters is intent, what people are doing in the moment. So Google isn't giving up that much. So thanks, but no thanks, Facebook and Google. Money talks and bullshit walks. Both of these moves are nothing burgers. Please try again.
On a separate front, Amazon is acquiring six-year-old Zooks, the company announced today. Amazon said the deal will help bring Zooks's, quote, vision of autonomous ride-hailing to reality. This is an interesting tie-up and one that the Wall Street Journal had reported last month was in the works. First, it's worth noting that Zooks will continue to operate as a standalone business, with its current CEO, Aicha Evans, and its CTO, Jesse Levinson, continuing to lead the team. Also, the terms of the deal were not disclosed, but the Financial Times reported that Amazon is paying a little more than $1.2 billion to acquire the company. That's roughly one-third what its private investors thought it was worth 3 years ago. I don't know that the valuation knock was specific to Zooks, though maybe so. I mean, there's certainly been a broader cooling of enthusiasm around self-driving technologies as the industry grapples with the high costs associated with building autonomous driving tech and the fact that none of this stuff is going to be ready for prime time time as soon as was hoped perhaps 5 years ago. Either way, the big question is, how is Amazon going to use Zoox's technology? A lot of companies like Aurora, which is a company that Amazon has also backed, have been working on self-driving technologies that they plan to license to car makers. Zoox, in stark contrast, was trying to build self-driving robo-taxis from scratch with no steering wheel and wheels that can turn sideways for tight maneuvers for truly parallel parking. Zoox has not unveiled publicly its vehicle prototype, though everyone wants to see it. It was supposed to happen sometime this year. Instead, it's been out in the world testing its self-driving car software using retrofitted Toyota Highlanders. So maybe Amazon will spend billions of dollars to get those vehicles across the finish line. It's just not saying right now, but it's always interested in being able to offer cheaper and faster delivery. And so it must see Zoox as a way that it gets there. A funny wrinkle in all of this, Alex, you and I talked last week, or maybe it was the week before, about Elon Musk, who was tweeting at the time about Amazon being a monopoly that needs to be broken up. Musk and Bezos both have space companies, of course, that are going head to head. But I don't think Musk loves Bezos moving into autonomous driving either, given that Musk also runs Tesla. In fact, Musk being Musk, he today tweeted that Bezos is a copycat using a cat emoji. Musk just cannot help himself. On the venture front, Lee Fixel is raising one of the biggest debut funds ever, according to the Financial Times. The former Tiger Global investor is reportedly about to close on $1.3 billion, which is a lot of money, particularly given the COVID crises and all of the questions about the global economy that it has raised. The FT said the fund came together quickly, and maybe so. It's worth noting that Fixel left Tiger around a year ago, and Tiger told its clients at the time that he might start an investment firm in the future. Either way, Fixel is an investor of great interest to a lot of people in this industry and to this audience in particular. For one thing, he has always been low flying, operating in the shadows, unlike many investors who, you know, you don't want to get between them and a camera or a microphone or risk being flattened. He also just seems to be very good at what he does. I don't know Tiger well enough to credit Fixel with all of the smart bets made on his watch, but I think he was really spearheading the firm's move into a lot of venture-backed companies, and he built up quite a portfolio, including Stripe, the payments company that's currently valued at $36 billion as of its most recent round in April. Tiger also led the Series B round for Peloton, the favorite fitness startup of the well-heeled. The company is now valued at $16.5 billion, which is incredible to me. Tiger also invested in Ola, the India-based ride-hailing company, and it also smartly sold part of its stake in Ola to SoftBank, because Ola, along with a lot of other ride-hailing companies, has had a very bumpy 2020 owing to the coronavirus. Not last, Tiger made a very early bet on Flipkart, which sold the majority of its e-commerce business to Walmart back in 2018 for $16 billion. I don't think the FT piece dives into what Fixel's new firm, Addition, will be focused on, but I'd guess that India will be a big area of focus given that he's been tracking the market there for so long. And of course, there's just a lot of room for growth, especially compared with the US market, which seems sort of clogged with a lot of overpriced Me Too companies at this point.
And on a lighter note, we bring you news of a Miami spec home that just hit the market for $34 million. Sure, this 15,560 square foot manse has six bedrooms, roughly 6,500 square feet of terraces, a rooftop garden with a wet bar and a jacuzzi, a gym, a wine cellar that can hold more than 1,000 bottles, a club room with a movie projector, a formal dining room with seating for about 20 people, an infinity edge pool, an outdoor kitchen, and a dock with a 55,000-pound boat lift. But the waterfront property's showcase feature is a $1 million 5,600-gallon saltwater aquarium imported from Japan that was so heavy it had to be transported to the mansion via barge. To service the aquarium, a scuba diver enters through a hatch hidden in the master bedroom closet. Ah, simple pleasures.
Up next, our interview this week with Michael Kim, the founder and managing partner of Sendana Capital, a fund of funds that invests in seed VC funds. Kim has stakes in a number of firms whose names you would recognize: Uncork, Freestyle, Founder Collective, Forerunner, Collaborative Fund, and many more. He's starting to invest internationally. We had a really fun time talking with him. So stay tuned. But first, a word from our sponsor.
want to hitch a ride on Falcon 9's next trip to the International Space Station? That will set you back $55 million. Luckily, you don't need that much cash to access investments in private companies pushing the frontier of tech innovation. Enter Equity Zen. Through its pooled funds, Equity Zen lets you invest in pre-IPO companies like SpaceX and Rivian. Sign up to explore Equity Zen's private market today.
So we're so happy to have Michael Kim here today of Sindana Capital. Michael, this is like your 10th anniversary, is that right?
Yeah, you know, I started Sindana in the beginning of 2010, and I really got underway after the birth of my son, which was in August of 2010. And so it's about 9.5 years. You know, it took me a year and a half to actually raise that first fund. So our first fund is from 2012.
That's right. I remember it was like a $28 million fund and people didn't really understand your strategy, which was to basically fund other fund managers who are starting seed funds.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, even today, I think we're still one of the only pure plays doing that in the institutional LP world. You know, there are other fund of funds that invest in seed funds, obviously, but we're still, I think, the only one that focuses exclusively on seed. And I think, to be honest, the strategy's worked out well. You know, the world is certainly a different place. When I started Sindana in 2010, there were probably 10 to 15 seed funds. And then if you remember, a bunch of super angels. But now, you know, people say that 800 to 900 seed funds in the US alone.
Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy. So, I mean, I did wonder if you feel like the pace of fund formation is accelerating or decelerating. I mean, we've just seen so much. I just wondered if we'd finally hit some sort of tipping point where things are maybe moving in the opposite direction or not quite yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point because, you know, with 800 to 900 seed funds, you know, clearly the barrier to entry is relatively low. So if you're you and a few of your engineer friends from Facebook or wherever, you know, made a few million dollars and you cobbled that together, suddenly you're a seed fund, right? And so there's a lot of groups like that, but we do think that there's only probably 5% of that total that are probably institutional quality, meaning managing outside capital in a professional way.
Right, right. So I wanted to ask, so the last time we talked, you had raised a bunch of money across a number of funds and you had stakes in 15 early stage funds. Is that still the case or how many stakes do you have at this point?
That's a good question. You know, we have probably over 70 portfolio funds that we've invested with, but that doesn't mean we have 70 different firms. A fund like, say, Freestyle, where we came in their first fund, they're investing out of fund 5. And so, you know, we're an LP in each one of those funds. And so of our core relationships, we probably have about 20, 23. And that's also increased because starting 2 years ago, we began investing outside the US. So now we have non-US seed fund managers.
Okay. And I want to get into that for sure. I also wanted to ask, I remember that there was sort of a tipping point in terms of where your LPs thought you could be most effective, which was funding managers whose funds were $100 million or less. Is that still the case?
Yeah. I mean, you know, clearly over the last 5 years, the average size of a seed fund that we're involved with has increased. So I think it actually went from 40 million to about 95 million. One thing that I think an evolution of the market that we look at since we last talked to you about this is that we think pre-seed is a distinct category. So in our world, we differentiate between seed funds, which are about 90 to 100 million in size, and the pre-seed funds, which we think are largely about 35 to 45 million in size.
Interesting. Okay. So of those 20 to 23 stakes, it sounds like maybe the newer ones are pre-seed funds or is it a mix?
Yeah. I mean, the universe of pre-seed funds is much, much smaller. And also we have to be careful that someone doesn't go out and try to become a seed fund and they fail and they don't raise enough. So they suddenly are now a pre-seed fund. So, you know, we look for dedicated fund managers at the pre-seed stage. And just to give you a sense of what that means to us, these are fund managers like Manu Kumar at K9 or Tim Connor at Pivot North or Dustin Rosen at Wonder. They're looking at ideas. They're looking at a founder who may have a PowerPoint, may not even have a co-founder. So it's extremely early stage.
Mm-hmm. And why is that interesting to you?
Well, you know, from a financial perspective, our pre-seed managers are investing 500K to a million and getting 15 to 20% ownership. Since we last talked about this, I think the average seed round now is probably 3 million in size at a 9 million pre. And so valuations have increased because the round size has increased. But at the same time, these seed stage companies are actually more fully baked. They have management teams. They have product market fit. They have revenue. They have traction. So one way that we think about the world is that the seed funds are really what Series A funds were doing when Kleiner and Sequoia and Accel got going in the early 70s. They were working with companies that were getting going. So effectively, this is an overused phrase, to be honest, but seed is the new A. And if you look at what A rounds look like, the gold-plated Series A is from Sequoia, 12 on 30. And, you know, 10 years ago, that would have been a Series B. So everything's just kind of shifted. And so we think we're squarely in the early stage venture ecosystem.
So, Michael, one thing that I remember was also important to you was your fund managers having an ownership stake of at least 15%-ish in a company. But, you know, there's also the concern that sometimes by the time these startups get to the new Series A, they've given away too much of their company. So if the pre-seed VCs are getting 15% and then the seed stage VCs are getting, I'm not sure what's average, maybe 10%, a quarter of the company is gone by the time it gets to the Series A. I'm just wondering, has that proved problematic in any way? Or do you have any thoughts about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really insightful observation. And that's a major issue for founders because in a way, before they raise a Series A, they could have raised a friends and family round, they could have raised a pre-seed round, a seed round, and then a seed extension round. So even four rounds of capital before they even raise the A, right? And so I think a well-known case is where, you know, Aaron Levy, when Box went public, he owned 4% of the company, right? And clearly founders would rather own more than single digits. And so sure. I think what we really see is that the pre-seed fund managers are backing these companies and they actually skip the seed round. And so they actually go from pre-seed to A. The other thing really, quite frankly, is that seed rounds are meant to provide 18 months of runway. And in those 18 months, a founder should be able to get the milestones to raise a Series A, but the goalposts keep moving. And so Series A funds want to see a lot more traction. And historically, it used to be that, you know, a Series A fund would want to see like a million ARR from a company before they would consider it. And I think that goalpost has moved to even 1.5 to 2 million. So that means companies have to be more fully baked, have a lot more traction, and, you know, a seed round of 2 million, 3 million might not be enough. And that's why you're actually seeing seed rounds actually increasing size to like 4 to 5 even. I mean, they're still rare, but I think you're seeing larger seed rounds.
This is sort of a devil's advocate question, but given the fact that starting a company has gone down so radically over the last 10 to 15 years, why do you find that these seed funds are raising such large seed funds? And doesn't it suggest that some of these entrepreneurs are trying to mitigate risk to an extreme degree?
No, that's a really good question, Alex. So, you know, I think, as I mentioned, seed rounds are meant to provide 18 months of runway. You know, clearly between now and to like say 1999, it has actually become cheaper because back then you needed $5 million to start a software company because you had to buy servers, you had to pay for software licenses. And, you know, with Amazon Web Services and open source software, it's a lot cheaper, but it's been ticking up. And the reason why is because the Bay Area is an extremely expensive place. A startup would have to compete against Salesforce, Facebook, Google, Twitter, all these companies that are willing to pay a couple $100,000 for a developer, whereas a startup obviously can't do that, really. The promise of economic gain is actually from the stock options. And so, you know, over the past 5-6 years, it just became more expensive to hire a team. Now, clearly, in this new COVID world, that's moved slightly back. And then another trend that we've seen is that no one now is trying to have their entire team under one roof. And that was even before shelter in place. So, you know, you'd have perhaps the executive team in San Francisco, but then a distributed team where the developers were in Portland or Chicago or Austin or Boulder. So I think that model is actually just going to get accelerated with shelter in place and the work from home. But that's the primary reason why seed rounds have gotten larger. It's just become more expensive to build out a team.
Mike, obviously you mentioned COVID-19's impact. Can I ask, what are you seeing in your portfolio? I'm just wondering if we're seeing a lot more companies go under. It really seems like a timing thing. You know, if a company had raised seed funding maybe last fall, I could see them potentially being in trouble if they couldn't raise a little bit more for insiders. Whereas if they maybe close something in March, they could just kind of maybe put a pin in their plans and try to ramp up now.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you hear all of our, you know, fund managers talking about triage. So COVID hits, shelter in place hits, top line looks really challenging for some type of companies in certain sectors. And so our fund managers, basically, when we say triage, that means that they looked at which companies are their value drivers, you know, the ones that are tracking the best, which ones have probably have had up rounds, and then also the ones that are not. And then they bucket those into less than 12 months of runway, 18 months of runway, or more than 24 months of runway. I think across our portfolio, our fund managers have said that basically 80% of their value driving companies have actually 24 months or more of runway, which I guess is a really good thing, obviously, in the time of uncertainty. But the true answer here is that no one really knows the impact of your top line. So if you're running like a ticket company or something in hospitality or travel, mm-hmm. you've seen 90% declines in your top line. But if you're an enterprise software company, you might think, well, you know, we're pretty insulated from this. Companies will just continue to renew their software. And the answer is no one really knows that. And so, you know, you've got to worry where the NASDAQ is hitting an all-time high, 10,000 plus, when there's 30 plus million people out of work. And you also have the impact of the stimulus that was covering rents, I think, through April, May, and June. But then that tails off. And so I would think that commercial real estate is going to take a major hit. Small businesses are going to take a major hit. We even see that from our own portfolio in that our fund managers are talking about not renewing their offices. And they're talking about their startups not renewing their office leases. So, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot more to be unveiled. And certainly the volatility around this potential second wave or a resurgence, even in the first wave, I think that's putting a lot of uncertainty in the market. And so our fund managers and their startups and founders have done what they can, you know, cut burn, make more reasonable top line assumptions. But ultimately, it's a real question of how this plays out. And there's one more element to this. A lot of the companies have actually cut burn and pushed off their fundraising. If you remember in 2008, in the private equity world, there was all this talk about a wall of debt coming due, right? A lot of those private equity buyout deals had a huge amount of debt coming due. And I think what you're going to see now is a wall of financings coming up in the next 2 to 3 quarters. And what I mean by that is all these you know, seed stage companies that deferred raising capital now, because it's the shelter in place kind of world, they're going to be coming back fourth quarter, first quarter, and the Series A funds are going to be completely inundated with this. And I think the bar is going to even be higher. And so you might actually see, sadly, mass mortality amongst the seed stage companies, especially of this cohort, you know, sort of like the 2019-20 seed stage companies.
Does that mean that that could put a lot of pressure on your returns?
It's most definitely a negative thing. What I would say is that people aren't just sitting on their hands. I think there are ways to potentially avoid that wall of financing. Specifically, existing investors could add to the round. So they reopen up the round or extend the round so that the company has cash flow through the second half of next year so that they're not coming up to a Series A financing when everybody else in the world is.
Yeah. And the, you know, you talked about debt. I think it'll be interesting to see too what happens on that front, because so many founders had started turning to debt providers in recent years to sort of supplement their rounds and stave off dilution.
But yeah, I mean, you know, in that world, basically you have venture debt funds like WTI. Then you also have the commercial banks like SVB. And so I saw the downturn in 2000 and also 2008. And the companies that were relying on venture debt really got ahead of their skis. And, you know, the banks especially are very keen on making sure they get repaid. I don't know if most founders know this, but if you have venture debt with a commercial bank, they can actually sweep your checking account and they can shut you down in an instant. Whereas the venture debt funds, which are more pricey, to be honest, to work with, they're more willing to pay and perhaps convert some of their debt to equity. But in a downturn, none of this looks good, quite frankly. One thing, though, specific to Sendana is that as a fund of funds, we're investing in 3 vintage years into these funds. And each of those funds themselves are investing over a 3-year period. So actually, we cover 6 vintage years. So we feel that we have enough diversification, not only in the number of companies, but also across vintage years.
Michael, I also wanted to ask you about secondary sales. I talked to Hans Swilden of Industry Ventures back in maybe late March or early April, and he was saying it's really too soon for a lot of industry players to be thinking about snapping up stakes because it was sort of like catching a falling knife at that point. We weren't sure where the bottom was. Of course, all of a sudden there was this big bounce back up. I'm just wondering, how are you thinking about secondary sales in terms of your portfolio companies, but also your past funds? Have you sold anything?
There's two different kinds of secondaries we can talk about. One is the LPs selling off their positions because they're overexposed and may not have liquidity to make capital calls. The other, of course, is where you're selling your stake in a company in an investment. And so what I would say is that a number of our funds are actually in the top 5th percentile by Cambridge Associates for performance. And the reason why is our fund managers have done a number of secondaries. So if they have a company that suddenly becomes a unicorn, and let's say they're raising $500 million on a $2 billion valuation, our fund managers might have a position that might be 3x their entire fund. And so they will sell 20 to 30% of that in order to monetize. And that's really benefited us and our investors. So that was a really good activity when, you know, with the proliferation of unicorns and that type of financing. And I think that still will happen. There's such a huge amount of late stage capital that's actually committed. So it's not like hedge funds saying, yeah, we're going to play at this stage. If you look at Coatue, Tiger Global, Insight, those players all have large, large committed funds. And so they're all chasing after the same late stage deals. And that creates this opportunity where the early stage investors like our seed funds actually have that degree of freedom to say, I want to sell 30% into the round, and no one blinks an eye. Quite frankly, if you're Sequoia and you own 25% of a company, you cannot do a secondary because that sends such a negative signal to the market. So, you know, that's been very good to us for the last 18 months. I think it'll slow down to some extent because there aren't that many very large late stage rounds being done. Although, you know, if you saw the information today, they showed that the late stage rounds have actually increased in value over the last two quarters. But in general, our fund managers most definitely have benefited from that. And by association, we have too. Now, we've actually seen in this sort of COVID world, some instances where our fund managers might have an LP or two that are having liquidity issues or can't really make their cap call. So they offer to sell their LP interest to us. And, you know, these are small pieces that we would take a good look at. A few of our LPs have actually asked us to start an initiative around this. It could be a good opportunity for us and our investors. But as of right now, it's still early stage in our thinking.
Some of these VC funds have raised so much money, and I'm just wondering, to what extent are they trying to copy your model and invest in smaller funds themselves in order to capture early stage deal flow?
That is a really good observation because, you know, back in the day, like the mid 2000s, you wouldn't see VC funds investing in seed funds or in any other fund, right? In fact, their LPAs, your LP agreements typically prohibited that, but now you see it actually as a strategy. So almost every fund manager that we meet, they're like, yes, you know, Brad Feld, Chris Dixon, Mark Andreessen, they're investing with us. But, you know, I think that's a specific strategy. Those guys have the liquidity to go invest in a bunch of seed funds. And, you know, I think that gives them visibility into the early stage market. So I would say Andreessen, Lightspeed, you know, I actually did a call yesterday with Foundation, and they have actually a structured program to do this. And so we're seeing a lot more of the Sand Hill Road crowd actually using this as another arrow in their quiver, right? They have scout programs, they're investing in seed funds. It's smart because they want to have the visibility and access to the earliest stage things.
It's kind of funny because we've seen LPs moving into the GP role and investing directly into companies, and now we're seeing GPs moving into the LP space.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's kind of a convergence. I wanted to ask you about sort of the general landscape for fund of funds. You said once on a podcast, I think most VC fund of funds are terrible. They're asset gatherers. They want AUM. They want management fees. A lot of them don't even charge carry. Can you talk a little bit about your structure and what makes you different and how you're incentivized?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, just to be very upfront about that, we think our carried interest is the greatest alignment of interest possible with our investors. And so just to be really specific about it, our economics are 1 in 10, meaning we charge a 1% management fee annually and we get 10% carry. To be extremely clear about it and transparent, that's a stacked fee. That's on top of what our fund managers charge. So our fund managers charge typically 2.5 and 20. And so Cendana LPs are paying 3.5 and 30. And you might think, well, that seems pretty egregious. But, you know, a number of our LPs either are not staffed to go address this market or are too large, like the University of Texas, to actually write smaller checks to these seed funds. And so, you know, I think we provide a pretty interesting value proposition to them. But, you know, overall, a lot of these well-known fund of funds are asset gatherers. They're not charging a carried interest. They're in it for the management fee. They have shiny offices around the world. They have hundreds of people working at them. And, you know, they're raising billion plus funds and they're putting 30 to 50 names into each one. And so in a way, they become index funds. And I don't think venture is really an asset class, unlike an ETF that's focused on the S&P 500. Venture capital is where a handful of fund managers capture most of the alpha, most of the return. And so you don't want an index fund. And in fact, our differentiation is that we're creating very concentrated portfolios. So in our fund of funds, we typically have 11, 12 names, and that's it. Our strategy actually is to be the largest LP in each of those funds. And I think that sort of high conviction approach has done really well for us. I feel that that's exactly what we look for in our fund managers. We specifically look for fund managers who lead their investments because we think ownership is paramount.
We talked to a guest last week who was saying that VC trails the S&P 500. Are you guys net of fees better than the S&P 500? Are you beating the indexes?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at our oldest fund, which is the Cendana One, it's a 2012 vintage. It's marked at north of 3x, and that's net of everything. That's net of our portfolio fund managers, fees and expenses and carries, and that is net of Cendana economics, and we're over 3x on that. That translates actually to, I think, a 31% net IRR, and that's since inception. In the past 8 years, we've generated over 30% return annually from that fund. I don't have the S&P 500 in front of me, but I think that compares probably very favorably to the S&P 500, probably about the same for NASDAQ, just because the FANG have, plus Microsoft have been so strong. But, you know, I think we've provided substantial alpha to our investors.
Michael, I wanted to talk to you about diversity, which is very much top of mind. And you mentioned these LPs being on autopilot to a certain extent. How do you think about diversity? I mean, do you have targets in your own mind in terms of either new managers that you want to fund or else maybe seeing more of the fund managers with whom you're already working better diversify their own investing teams?
One of the most important things is that it's founder driven. So the average founder is not your 1950s Leave It to Beaver founder, you know, not a white male necessarily. You have a greater diversity of the founders, whether it's women or people of color. And so I think for any venture capital fund, they need to have a partnership that can understand, appreciate, empathize with a more diverse set of founders. You look at the VC firms of today, Series A and above, you see a lot more diverse GPs. Now, clearly, in the overall scheme of things, there's a lot of criticism that it's still too homogenous. And, you know, clearly that's true. But, you know, I think as LPs, we can drive a lot of change. One of the initiatives that we've been thinking about is actually working with Lo Tony, a good friend of ours for 20 years. I know he's been on your podcast, but he started the firm Plexo Capital. And Lo and I have been working pretty closely on thinking through some of the initiatives that we can do as LPs. And, you know, we want to be very supportive of Lo and his ideas. And so specifically, one of them is actually to provide an internship to a student from a historically Black college or university. We would do this annually where we would sponsor an intern that would work very closely with us and not in some superficial way, but actually to learn our business, how we evaluate managers, how we think about portfolio construction, what type of diligence we do. If you think of that over a 10-year period, that's 10 students from an HBCU that now has an interesting work experience with Cendana Capital on their resume and actually could go into the institutional LP world. And who knows, maybe some of them actually end up being an important staff member at Harvard Management Company or Princeton's endowment or a large endowment or foundation. That's a tangible way that I think that we, you know, Cendana Capital specifically could help with underrepresented minorities getting into positions of influence in the LP world which I think does ultimately drive the GP world and the VC world.
Is there any way that you can codify your investments in firms with language that requires a certain level of diversity among the managers or among the investments that are made?
I know Mark Suster at Upfront has done that and announced that, you know, in their term sheets, they actually have a provision about that for their the management companies of the startups that they fund. But I've also known that they've had issues about actually finding a sufficient number of candidates for that. I think it's more effective to actually have real conversations with the fund managers and share our perspective on this. Somewhat related to that, we do a weekly Zoom call with all of our fund managers. And, you know, tomorrow, the topic actually is around how do we help increase the number of underrepresented minorities in the venture world. I'm going to ask specifically each one of them to consider doing an internship with someone from an HBCU or certainly an underrepresented minority. And I think if we have 25 plus fund managers, each one of them brings on an intern that's underrepresented minority every year, that's 25 new people who have meaningful VC experience. Those are actual tangible ways, instead of just hand waving and virtue signaling on Twitter, that the LP and GP world could actually address the situation here.
That's really terrific. I absolutely love that idea. You know, Michael, I wanted to talk to you about LPs, something that we've talked about in the past. A lot of these people at these endowments, hospital systems, pension funds, work for the organization for a limited amount of time, and it makes them very risk averse because they don't want to necessarily gamble on a new manager. And I think that's probably gotten worse during this period of time. I talked to LPs back in March who said candidly, especially with the stock market going crazy, they were really not interested in talking to new managers. They just kind of wanted to preserve their relationships. And like you, I guess, if there was an opportunity to get a bigger piece of a firm because one of their LPs had grown shaky, right, they're looking into that as well. So you've got the COVID thing going on. You also have this new interest and focus on new managers, people of color. How does that net out?
Now, that's a brilliant question because there's almost two countervailing dynamics going on, right? You have a huge interest in trying to help proactively underrepresented minorities, but yet we're in a COVID world, right? And so you're absolutely right. I think most institutional LPs, nothing against them, but you know, they're generally employees and they're not incentivized necessarily the right way, meaning you don't get fired for buying IBM, right? Mm-hmm. And so they may not have the economic interest to take a risk on something that may ultimately generate huge returns. Some of the earlier funds that we invested in are like 10, 20X kind of funds. And there are no other institutional LPs with them because they were unknown or they're a single GP or whatever. But bringing it back to your question specifically, one sort of common aphorism right now is that, you know, COVID has accelerated a lot of trends. And I think that's actually potentially happening in the LP world around underrepresented minorities. So, you know, I think you're absolutely right in that, you know, on the one hand, endowments and foundations are probably frozen in terms of making new commitments because of the market volatility. They may be overweighted because their public equity valuations have dropped. And so they might put everything on pause. But on the other hand, you know, I think there's a loud clarion call to help underrepresented minorities in any way you can. That may actually spur more LP interest in funds run by underrepresented minorities. You know, Lo and I actually did a call last week to talk about this specifically. You saw, for example, Google making their announcement about allocating $100 million specifically to this initiative. Mm-hmm. Lo having come out of GV and actually helping develop this strategy for them, it was given a $25 million allocation out of that pool. So I think overall, you're going to see more action and more initiatives around underrepresented minorities in venture capital, notwithstanding COVID and notwithstanding some of the endowments and foundations being frozen about new commitments.
Right, right. And I guess to your point, maybe it'll just come from different sources, Alphabet, SoftBank, strangely, Facebook. Right. Also, Michael, I know you've got to get going, but I wanted to ask, you mentioned at the outset that you're interested more in funding more international managers. So what's interesting to you? What areas, what types of new managers are you talking about?
We've always been very focused on ecosystems. And what we mean by that is, you know, high quality entrepreneurs, high quality co-investors, and a lot of local follow-on capital. So not to pick on Istanbul, but that's kind of an extreme example. We've met with all the seed funds in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about, well, who does your follow-on investing, they talk about, you know, firms from Berlin, London, East Coast of the United States flying in to look at their companies. You know, early stage venture is hard enough, but if you have to rely on someone flying in, that makes it even more difficult. Over the last 5 years, we felt that certain ecosystems have gotten better. So for example, in London, a lot of seed funds, not many Series A funds. You know, historically it was like Balderton Index, Accel London, and a few others. Now you have Blossom, Felix, Mosaic, the Scandinavian funds like Creandum and Sunstone and some others getting much, much larger. You have Lakestar getting to 750 million. You know, I think there's just a lot more Series A funds, and that makes it for a better ecosystem. So specifically, we've actually invested in Israel with Entree Capital, in London with Matthias Lungman, who was the co-founder of Atomico, with Matt Golden and Golden Capital in Toronto. Actually invested in an Australian and New Zealand fund manager called Blackbird. And you might have seen their name recently because of they were the seed investor in Canva. Phenomenal group of GPs there. And then also we have investments in India with a group called Leo Capital, which is a very unique firm because it's run by an ex-entrepreneur named Rajul Garg. And he's extremely rare in India because he's a two-time founder of companies that have become unicorns. And so in India, a lot of the VCs are actually ex-bankers and people, you know, like actually ex-lawyers too. And so he's unique because he's very founder-friendly, exactly what we look for in the US. And he has a track record of building two unicorns. And then also, and we have a few fund managers in China. I guess the best known one would be Matt Cheng, who runs Cherubic. And they're a little bit unique because 40% of their portfolio is here in the US. And so, for example, Matt was the first investor in Hims and led their seed round. And he's also the first investor in Wish and Flexport. In a way, he's a bridge for those companies to be active in China. And he's done a phenomenal job. As I mentioned before, we look for fund managers who lead their investments. And with our international ones, we actually have another bar, which is we have to see demonstrated track records of distributions. Because you know what they say about international VC, which is it's like the Roach Motel. Capital goes in, but nothing comes out. And so we want to actually see fund managers who've actually returned meaningful capital to their investors.
That's all very interesting because I remember a time when, you know, you were sort of hesitant to invest even in LA and Boston. So the fact that you're all over the place right now is a huge shift.
Thank God we did LA because that was mucker. And, you know, we did that as a pilot. So we have that program where we invest up to $1 million to groups we like, but we have some question about their ecosystem or story. And we did that mucker investment as a pilot. And that was the fund that Honey was in. Right.
Oh, that's great. And,
you know, I think it was publicly, it was announced that they own like 7% of Honey. And, you know, at $4 billion, that's $280 million. But what really is not known is that that fund was only $12 million in size.
Wow.
Phenomenal return for those guys.
Yeah. I don't know if that story's been covered enough. I'm guessing that you're going to be announcing funds soon based on the fact that we talked last about your newest funds in 2017. I guess going forward, what percentage of your assets do you see going abroad? I mean, obviously, there's a ton going on in India. And I guess China is kind of coming back to life now as well.
Right. So I can't talk about fundraising until July 1. Hint, hint. So that's all I can say about that. But if we were to have a new fund, I would think that the way we would allocate it would be about 60% to seed funds, about 20% to pre-seed, because quite frankly, there are less pre-seed funds. And also about 20% to non-US. And so that's kind of how we think about our own portfolio. Our bread and butter is definitely the seed funds. We're writing $15 million checks to those. And for pre-seed and international, we're writing $7.5 million. So, you know, we moderate it in size and number, but, you know, each of these portfolios would be concentrated. We, again, try to be the largest investor in each one of them.
And Michael, before you go, one last question. You mentioned this program where you take a risk on a up-and-coming manager with maybe like $1 million stake. The last time we talked, I think that company was Notation Capital, the Brooklyn-based venture firm. Who is your newest bet right now?
Yeah, in fact, newest pilot commitment is to Katie Stanton, who runs a firm called Moxie. She raised $25 million. She was the VP of International at Twitter. She was at Google before that. And then after Twitter, she worked for Hillary Clinton, the U.S. State Department. And so someone who has a very unique background and a very unique set of networks that are differentiated from our other fund managers. And actually, that's something that we think about. When we look at a fund manager, we think about his or her networks and how that overlays with our other fund managers. And we're trying to cover as much of the world as possible. In a way, venture investing is like fishing. You got to know where to fish. You got to know where to cast the net. And then you have to be able to bring it in. We think of each of our fund managers as casting different nets. In general, these pilots, the idea is that we work with them for a year or two. And then ultimately, if it all works well, then they become a core position for us. And then we write $15 million or $7.5 million to them.
Right. Great. Michael, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. This is a lot of fun.
Great. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye.
That's the show. Thank you, everybody.
Yes, thanks, everyone. Stay tuned for next week. We will be talking with Morgan DeBon, who runs the venture-backed startup Blavity, a very fast-growing media company centered on Black millennials. We're very excited to talk to her. Have a great week, everyone.